listener production.
Public housing for poor people. People are like, oh, that's bad. You're getting something for nothing. Public housing for the military. Oh, that's great. These guys are great. They deserve a free house. Public housing for the Prime Minister. Oh, that's fine too. Give him two houses, right? The Prime Minister doesn't need a free house. He's the Prime Minister.
G'day, I'm Scott Phillips and welcome to The Good Oil. Now, you know by now, giving someone the good oil is giving them the good stuff, the important stuff and the real stuff, which is the aim of this podcast. We talk to entrepreneurs, executives and experts, the people who know what's going on and the people who make things happen. Today's guest is absolutely someone who knows what's going on and has written a book about it. Before we get to that, you've heard Dr. Cameron Murray before. We actually featured a conversation he and I had with the Aussie Firebug podcast to talk about superannuation. So this is his second time on the podcast stream, but the first time being interviewed. Now, if you haven't caught up with that, firstly, do that. But if you haven't yet, I'm going to say he needs a better PR person because he's very, very humble. On his LinkedIn profile, he simply says, I'm an economist specializing in property and urban development, environmental economics, rent seeking, and corruption. Now, if that sounds interesting, it absolutely is. And he's a very, very smart and thoughtful bloke. Dr. Cameron Murray, welcome to The Good Oil.
Thanks for having me, Scott. It's great to be here.
Mate, I've been wanting to talk to you for ages, and the impetus was you have a brand new book out. You've already written a book called Rigged, or Game of Mates. It's had two separate titles, if you ever listeners have heard or seen either of those two. The brand new one, though, the one we're talking about now, is The Great Housing Hijack. Now, I'm going to ask you about that, mate. Before I do, I'm going to tell our listeners what other people think of it, because you know, I was lucky enough, you sent me a little bit of a pre-release version. By the time this goes out, the book will be available, by the way. So go and buy it. We'll tell you how in a minute. But you sent me an early version, and the first two, you get those, what are they called, recommendations, little blurbs that other people write about you and write about the book. Ross Gittins, the man who should be knighted, said, quote, if you're not sure you believe the official story of why house prices and rents are so high, read this. And then Michael Pascoe, who is an absolute gun, just like Ross, says, quote, the vast majority of what is written and said about Australian housing is either nonsense, property porn, clickbait or lies, all more or less to the benefit of interests vested in maintaining the status quo of ever more expensive shelter with all the social damage that causes. Cameron Murray's The Great Housing Hijack is the exception that proves the rule. The only book you need to understand the giant con we have fallen for. Nobody escapes unscathed. Read it. Now, mate, I got to say, I don't know how much money you had to pay Pascoe to say that, but no, I'm kidding. That is a sensational recommendation. Greg Jericho also gives, I won't read them all that. You've got some very, very impressive and well-credentialed people to say very nice things about your book, people who won't say it unless it's true, mate. So congratulations on the book. It is called The Great Housing Hijack. I'm going to let you talk in a second. I am going to just ask you up front, what is The Great Housing Hijack?
Well, maybe before I answer that, I should remind you, my first book was written about corruption, political favoritism. So the fact that I'm getting a network of mates saying nice things should be no surprise at all.
I see.
So
you've learned well.
People used to say, is this a how-to guide or what? And I said, well, I guess it can go both ways. And well, that's sort of true in the new book, The Great Housing Hijack. It's almost... is it a how-to guide for property investors or is it a guide to understanding policy options and how to get different outcomes from housing? It's called The Great Housing Hijack because the debate about housing has been hijacked from vested interests from all sides for not just this cycle, not just this crisis, but for centuries. And I actually look at the history of the last 200 years in Australia and show that we've had the same debates that seem to go nowhere repeatedly every property cycle for 200 and whatever years. And so my frustrations boiled over a few years ago. I remember in May 2020, I was doing a podcast with the guys at Macro Business and I said, you know, we've got a COVID, we've got this lockdown, we've got this crisis, but my understanding of the market suggests to me prices are more likely to rise 20% than fall 20%, even though all the bank economists say prepare for a 30% crash. And a few people agreed with me, of course, online, but a lot just said, yeah, where'd you get your economics degree? Back of a cornflakes packet? And right. So I always just thought, just you can say anything about housing, you know? And here's another example. I put out on Twitter, what's wrong with housing? Tell me, because we're just talking past each other. Everybody's got their own unique housing crisis, right? Property developers, the crisis is no one's buying and construction costs have gone up. Landlords, the crisis is land tax has gone up and, you know, they're on the hook for example, construction defects. Renters, the crisis is rents have gone up, but also they went rent down for 5 years in the capitals, but now they're going up, so I'm upset. Everyone's got their own story. And so I asked on Twitter, my followers a few years ago, what's wrong with housing? And some said, there's too much sprawl, it's ruining our country. Some said, there's too much gentrification and infill, we need more detached houses for starter houses. Some said, interest rates are too low, prices are going up. Others said, interest rates are too high, it's hard to get a mortgage. It went on and on. People having the exact opposite interpretation. And I cracked and I thought, someone has to just lay things out and make sense of this. And I guess that person is me, and show the incentives for different groups, to the media's incentives to talk up anything and ignore the contradictions with the story they did yesterday, the landlord's incentives to avoid any kind of regulations on rent and say, no, we want rents to go down. That's just the wrong way to do it. A property developer's incentive to game, you know, planning rules and sort of say it's a supply issue. All you got to do is subsidize us. Everyone's got an incentive. Even the academics don't get off the hook, because I feel like, you know, the academics are very much into, you know, I've done it too. I'm guilty. Creating new words. Oh, it's the financialization of housing. Oh, it's the whatever. And I just think housing's doing what it always does. I wish we just could talk about that straight before we start lobbying for our own personal preferences about policy changes. And so this is my attempt to set it straight, show the economics of housing markets that have operated for centuries, that even operate in online video games that have housing markets. All the same stuff happens, right? Get that straight, understand the political incentives in the debate, and get straight, well, if you now understand this and you are happy with these political trade-offs, these are some options for you, and this is what we've done elsewhere. That's the book.
So I'm going to get you to give our listeners a bit of a shallow dive, not a deep dive, by the book. But I'll get you to highlight some of the key thoughts. Before I do, let's do the Cameron Murray story just a little bit. How did you become an economist, then an academic economist, then decide to launch, in a very gutsy but very, I think, warranted and very pleasing way, your own economic think tank? What's the Cameron Murray story?
I'll start with what I acknowledge in the book, and that is probably the story of economics and property started with when I was 19, my dad got cancer, and he said, I'm making you children buy a house, and I want to set you up financially if this thing goes bad. It didn't. He's lived another 23 years, but that was the start. And that was during the early 2000s boom. And I was studying engineering and I thought, you know what? People are just making money hand over fist in property. I got into, you know, my first place, dad helped us all us kids out. And I realized, oh, okay, this is an interesting game. I tried to sell real estate at Harcourts, you know, as a cadet agent. And I just realized that is not the game. The middleman game is not me. I want to do the investing, and I think there's much more interesting stuff going on in this market. So I did a degree called property economics at QUT, and then ended up as a sort of cadet graduate at FKP, property developer. I was teaching classes after I graduated and shifted to work for Metroplex, which is an industrial developer. The guy there has now passed away, John Smallwood. He basically said, I need you to come work for me now. He was teaching a class at the university that I helped him with. And that sort of is where my interest in property grew. And then ultimately I ended up working in the government a little while in calculating developer charges and this sort of like local planning regulation and things like that. And eventually I decided I was frustrated with economics. I thought I'd become a doctor. I don't know if I've told you this, Scott.
Right.
I said, I want to do something useful every day with my life and make the world better. And so I actually studied for the GAMSAT, the entrance test to medical school, and I got accepted into medical school before, you know, I had literally a newborn second son and toddler at home, and my wife was very supportive, but I think a bit nervous that I'd become a student for another 10 years. And anyway, some doctor friends convinced me it's a bad thing to do, surprisingly. And Paul Friders was a professor at UQ, and he was a friend of mine. I'd met him when I studied a master's in amongst all that. And he said, look, you can do interesting things in economics. Come and do a PhD. You can use that time to understand all those things you've seen, working in property, working in regulation. And that's where the whole grey corruption type analysis comes into it. And that's sort of what kicked off where I am now. I've worked after the PhD, doing a bit of consulting, working at the University of Sydney, and now writing the book. And yeah, I feel like it's time to branch out on my own. I've accumulated the knowledge and experience now. So that's the story of me, and that's where I am. And fingers crossed, fresh economic thinking is great. I have a lot of supporters on there, and I think there's space in Australia for more voices at the moment.
I completely agree, mate, and more independent. And I will say, mate, I'll give you a wrap. The fresh economic thinking idea really is not the orthodox economics, nor is it off the wall. I want to also make that clear. You're not some raving whatever who's just going off on one. You're literally starting from first principles and regenerating the assumptions based on what history has shown, which is, I think, really important. And that's why I want to kick off the housing conversation, mate, because you said housing is doing what it's always done. And again, you illustrate that in the book. I end up being equal parts frustrated by that in one sense, i.e. is it really worth expecting anything to change? Do we bother? You know, if this is always going to happen, it's always going to happen. There is some element of Einstein's definition of insanity, or at least the alleged definition of insanity. The other is, it does give us a chance, maybe once and for all, or maybe for the first time, or maybe just every time we have one of these cycles, to address it appropriately, as you rightly pointed out. So can you give our listeners just a quick potted history, again, by the book, but give us a quick potted history of what it is about housing. How is it doing what it always does? What's the phenomena we're seeing?
The way I explain the economic forces at play in the housing market, I say there are five forces, five what I call equilibrium. So in economics, a big idea is equilibrium. And I'll use the example I use. If there's two supermarket checkouts and one queue has three people and one has 10, that's not an equilibrium, because people can switch from the long queue to the short queue and be better off. Only when they're the same length is that an equilibrium, right? And so this concept in economics of this emergent property applies in so many places. And so let me give you an example, the price of housing, right? Well, houses are an asset, and you can either allocate your dollars of other assets into housing, that's pick the supermarket queue and buy residential property, or you can sell it and take it and go into other assets, right? Like shares or like bonds or whatever you want. Keep it in cash. And so because of these equilibrium forces, that property asset prices can't just move independently, right? In the macro economy, they move with the rest of the asset market and the macro economy in general. So when people tell me things like house prices are high because there's a lack of houses, I'm like, prices can't just go up by themselves, right? Property is a $10 trillion asset class in a world of hundreds and hundreds of trillions of dollars of people who could sell one thing and buy houses, right? Or vice versa. If prices were super high, the yield would be super low, you know, 1% yield. Why would I own property and get a 1% yield when I can put my money in the bank? Right, so these are the forces that tie the housing market together. So that's one of five equilibrium forces that I use. One is rental markets. Like, rents can't just do whatever, right? They can't just go up and down. They have to come from somewhere. So So they're also a function of the income of the households competing in the rental market, because where does the money come from for rent? Well, the incomes of people who want to rent, right? And what are their trade-offs? Well, they could buy non-housing consumption goods or housing consumption goods. And it's, you know, what's surprising, and people don't observe this, and to be honest, I remember going through this mental learning or unlearning process of realizing that, hang on a minute, rent-to-income ratios, right? So the proportion of disposable income that renter households spend on rent is 20% today. Now, that seems low because a lot of renters have plenty of income, right? Dual income young professionals, right? But it was 20% in 2001, and it was 20% in 1991. And if you go and look at records from the various rental inquiries we had in 1910 and 1919 and 1920, people who've attempted to work out rent-to-income ratios get us around 20% then as well, right? So there's a distribution. I'm not saying some people don't pay a lot, but as the market adjusts and people can shift from one supermarket checkout to the other or change houses or move, this is where you always end up. And so I think we need to acknowledge, if we want to intervene in the market for housing, we have to understand what those economic forces are we're intervening in. We can't just do it on hope or frustration. We've got to do it on understanding.
That is a lovely way, I think, to really frame up what's going on. You talk about, and again, I'll share. By the way, I do really appreciate your commitment to alliteration in your chapter titles, Cam. As someone who also writes every now and again, the alliteration of the different housing hijackers you talk about distractions and distortions, and then within those, all the two word chapter titles are alliteration, which is lovely.
Yeah, I got a bit carried away, I think. But I needed something. You know, you've got to spice up a book about housing it grinds on you just talking about the yield on that and this planning rule does this. You got to spice it up.
That's right.
But thanks. I'm glad you noticed.
I did. I liked it a lot. So along with those equilibria, you talk about, and you've kind of subsections for your book. You've talked about the housing hijackers, distractions and distortions, the hoax housing policies, and most importantly, the course corrections. And I think you've done a wonderful job of setting things up. You start with a historical perspective. You throw on top of that the way to think about these five forces. And then you kind of go through how this is being distorted. The hijack, I suppose, is really in that middle part of the book, which is the way these issues are dealt with or not dealt with by the different forces. You talk about politicians, academics, the media. Yimby Yama, I thought, was probably my favorite chapter title, but plenty of others besides. Given the historical realities of the housing market, and given the way we have done it, I'm going to ask you the question outright just to provocatively on to start with. Do we actually have a problem? If this is what always happens, is there really a problem?
Yeah, so this is right. Like, and again, as I said at the start, when I asked people, they all had the opposite problems. So we use the word housing crisis because it's a good headline, but we actually use the word housing crisis to mean different things for different people every time we use it. And I think that is the big mistake. And I think there are incentives from all these groups to capitalize on a crisis, right? If I'm a landlord lobby group and someone says there's a housing crisis, well, of course, now's my chance to lobby for stuff I've always wanted. If I'm a huge developer with massive, you know, greenfield subdivisions out in the suburbs, now's the time to lobby for the government to build me subsidized building roads inside my subdivision, because that's what I've always wanted. But I'm using the word housing crisis because you all think it's the same thing. So it is a real change in reference point. And I hope you hope the message is in there that the market's doing what the market always does. There are periods in that market process of crises for different people. I remember a headline in 2018, prices and double whammy for investors, prices and rents falling in Sydney, right? Well, that was a crisis for investors in 2018. So the market's doing what it always does. And I think I want to change people's thinking from assuming that there is some problem with the market. If only we fixed the market would do something different.
Yeah.
To switching to the reverse and showing that throughout history, even in online games and virtual worlds and in every country that I looked at, property markets do very similar things. And it upsets some people some of the time and others other of the time. If we want a different outcome, we need to do something different to that market. And we have to understand the political trade-offs of intervening in the market, because one of the big ideas is called the symmetry of property markets. You know, every winner has a loser around this equilibrium outcome. Every time prices go up, new buyers have to pay more, but existing owners get more. And if you engineer a change through tax policy, rent, you know, regulations, you are creating winners and losers. So intervening becomes very difficult. And that's why a lot of what we talk about, it's just a political charades, right? Yeah, I've seen politicians in the morning tell renters, we're here for you, we're going to do this. And in the afternoon, promise landlords, we're definitely not going to regulate rents. Right? Because it's a game, and there's just so much value on the line for intervening. The question is, well, how did we get better outcomes, or have we ever done it? Who's done it? Why don't we look at that?
What I love about the book, mate, this is why, again, I'll say another couple of times, I'm sure, but read the book. When economists forecast, I kind of think, oh, guys, you're smarter than that. When economists explain, they are adding immense amounts of value for hopefully everybody who bothers to pay attention and read. And I say hopefully, and I say pay attention, because I'd love to say everybody, but some people will simply say, I don't want to hear that because it doesn't work for me. What is great about the Great Housing Hijack is you've basically started with, let me explain how this works. And then, as you say, once you know, is it algebra? I suppose I can use that metaphor. It's algebra, right? A plus B equals C. If you want to change C, you've got to change A or B. If you change B but not A, you're going to get a different C. The reality is, as you rightly point out, the question is, if you want a different outcome, you change something to deliver that. And that's what you lay out beautifully, is the moving parts, such that, you know, that there are winners and losers, there are ups and downs, there you know, every action has an equal opposite reaction. That idea of just simply, it's not a case of the crisis or even a crisis, but rather a range of outcomes in a market. And you lay out beautifully the ability for people who are reading to say, right, I get it. So if I push this, that then, you know, this bit moves, and if that bit moves, that bit moves. And do I want that or not? Rather than saying, this is the problem and therefore this is the solution. And that's what I mean about economists explaining rather than forecasting. You're simply saying, here's how this works, guys. And once you know that, then we can actually have some real conversations, as you say.
Well, that's, yeah. Thanks. I'm glad you got that out of the book, because that was my intention. I'm like, I would like to explain to people how to think straight and clear, you know, about what the market does before we decide it's a crisis or what the crisis is or how we're going to intervene. So let's do that first. And then once you've got that sort of clear thinking, that algebra of how A plus B equals C, or that, you know, what I would call the rental equilibrium, the price equilibrium, all that stuff, then everything else makes a lot more sense afterwards, right? And then, oh, that interest group says that. Oh, I see, because they want to subtract from C. Oh, that interest group says that. Oh, they want to add to A. Oh, I get. And then you can see all these incentives, and then you see how difficult it is politically to manage this. I'm not saying, you know, even if I was prime minister tomorrow, right, and I wanted to make houses cheap, it would be very difficult. Even if I had the whole party under my thumb doing whatever, it wouldn't be easy. And I you probably saw on Twitter yesterday or last week, I said, I would love it if we could just upzone, remove stamp duty and implement a land value tax, and housing would be cheap and everyone could buy a house. I would love it. I would love to not write this book. But if the, you know, if history is any guide, you know, not just the last 200 years, but I don't know if I told you, I got this great archaeological paper that translated all these tablets from ancient Mesopotamia, which were records of trades of property, right, thousands of years BC. And I used all that price and area data to replicate a method that's used to show that, you know, property is overvalued today. And I said, well, look, there it is, 3,000 years ago. This is just a normal outcome, all right? So, okay, it might not be great, but it's not something the market will correct. It's actually an equilibrium outcome in the market. And if you want to correct it, you have to really intervene heavily. And you know, if you assume the opposite, that nothing's going to change.
Yeah, you also mentioned Charles Darwin coming to Australia and saying everyone's talking about housing and house prices, and that's, again, yeah. History does nothing but repeat, does it really?
That was 1836. Remember, this guy's a biologist. He's looking for, think about all the animals Australia has that you would see on day one.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? In Sydney, it was less than 20,000 people. And the first thing he writes is not about the marsupials or anything. He's like, well, the people keep complaining about high rents and prices. That's the craziest thing ever. Yet there's the building houses everywhere. I don't get it.
Here we are,
Charles
again.
Darwin.
Here we are again.
That's nearly 200 years ago.
Mate, I was gonna leave it, but you've kind of mentioned that tweet, and so I want to kind of come back to it. The difficulty of having this conversation is, on one hand, as I said, I want to make clear and help people understand the way you've laid this out. Because what it then requires us to do is, once you know what the, and I'll use your equilibrium or my algebra, whatever metaphor works for people listening, and you say, okay, once we know how this works, then we can control for the outcomes we seek, knowing there are trade-offs and knowing there are winners and losers, and accepting that in a mature world, if we're not politicians, so we don't all have to pretend, as you say, that in the morning we love renters and in the afternoon we love landlords, but actually we care about the effectively social and economic outcomes of housing policy, which is really what they should be focused on. So we've sort of talked a little bit about defining the problem, if you like. I now want to get to that bit of the so what. Based on what you know, what would you do? But also, really importantly, mate, and this is, you know, this gets to values and it gets to ethics and it gets to how we design a society we all think is worth living in, and we want other people to live in as well. Why? What is it about your proposed solution that makes things, the market, better? What's that solution, and why is it the right solution?
Once you understand these forces in the market, you end up looking at, you know, the economist's favorite thing of stamp duty to land tax and going, oh, okay, well, stamp duty is a lot of money. People don't really notice it, and it makes the sticker price cheaper because the sellers pay it. And so, yeah, that's fine. We could introduce a land tax, but then we have all the age pensioners having to pay it. So we're going to have to subsidize the land tax by higher age pensions anyway. So what are we achieving exactly? Okay, so that's a tax reform that doesn't, you know, it has incidental outcomes on housing, right? You know, so...
Which, by the way, is not what most people think. If you listen to anyone argue about stamp duty and land tax, they believe it is, again, speaking of incentives, the most important thing.
Correct. And I think... I tried to reframe it, you know, about, you know, people say the financialization, it's bank lending and this and that. I'm like, yeah, well, you can direct who banks lend to, but when we had stricter lending in the 1960s, people complained that you couldn't get a mortgage unless you were a, you know, heterosexual couple household, right? And all these people were excluded from housing. So we said, okay, lend to anyone you want, right? You don't need a full-time job, check incomes, and now people are upset that that's bad. And so I guess I looked through history, I looked at other places, and I realized that if you want a different outcome, you have to offer some kind of non-market housing option. And we know that makes sense when it comes to schools. We know that if you make school compulsory, every child has to go to a school, that it's kind of a good idea to offer every child a free place at a public school. If we tried to make school compulsory but only have private schools, we'd be in the game of subsidizing this and tax breaks for that and all that sort of stuff, and people at the bottom would still kind of miss out and it would still be a drama. Imagine we did it for roads as well, and that's an example I use in the book. Imagine if we had no public thoroughfares. All the properties are joined together with no gaps in between, and you had to pay every single property owner to cross their land to the next place, to the next place. People would, imagine if we had the debate and go, oh, if only we had no stamp duty and land value tax, getting from A to B would be cheaper, even though you have to cross 50 different people's properties and pay a toll that they can set at whatever the market price is. And then, and we know in roads that public roads are cheap and fair and everyone gets it and we're all happy because it's universal. And private roads are expensive and they constrain access through the price, just like private property markets. And so I think it's kind of obvious when you also then look at housing and see that those public interventions are what's worked historically and in Australia, like abroad and in Australia. And I guess Australia after the Second World War would just literally subsidize people into houses. tens of thousands every year for two decades. We got the home ownership rate up, I think it was around 40 or 43% in the capital cities before the Second World War, and it was 71% by 1971 or 72. So in those 20 post-war years, we took 27%, a quarter of the whole population, out of rental and into home ownership through subsidized schemes. In Singapore, that's the most radical example. Singapore's independence in 1965, they had 20% home ownership, and they created a public housing option for everyone. And their home ownership rate got up to something like 88% in 1990. Right, so we're talking here 25 years from 20% to 88%. So they took 68% of the population out of rental drudgery and into home ownership. Now, it's not freehold title. It's not you can sell to the Chinese investor now. They also then sort of kept those properties in a parallel market just for residents of Singapore who don't own property elsewhere. They can buy and trade them. But anyone who can buy in that market gets to also currently buy a new off-the-plan subsidized apartment. And so by doing that, you're sort of creating this public option in parallel with the private market. And for Australia, I think this makes a lot of sense, because remember, the property market works for 67% of households who are homeowners. The 18% who are landlords, they're happy as well. And of the renters, there's about a third of households are renters. Probably half of them are very happy. They're living in nice, fancy apartments in the city. They have very mobile jobs and careers. So we actually only have this sliver of sort of 10 to 15% of the population that sort of wants to own a house but is currently stuck in the rental market. And if we could build up a parallel to subsidized home ownership scheme, it would really, really help them. And people who would sell out of their own private house could go into it if they wanted. But you could build that up over a decade, I think, pretty easily. Just like we build schools in every suburb of the city, you build little townhouse developments, little apartment buildings, little subdivisions sprinkled all through the cities. You can just buy them off private developers if you want, but then you sell them to people who don't own property, residents at a discounted price, and require them to only sell to other people who qualify for the scheme. And you do that for a decade. People shift out of the private market. Yeah, people might still want to go in the private market because they can make capital gains. It's, you know, gives them different options. All the benefits you get currently are still there, but we've added another option, right? So anyone who gets screwed over during a bad time in the market can get out, right? So I think that solves that, that navigates the politics as well, because you're not manipulating the price of the 67% of owned properties. You're not sort of heavily changing rental regulations, which are, I think there's a scope for a few improvements, but I don't think you want to get too radical. But you're just creating another option for people, directly doing the exact same thing that you think you want, which is the people who don't own houses should be able to get one cheaper. Okay, why don't we just give the people who don't own houses a cheaper option? And yeah, of course, we all got to subsidize a little bit, but if everyone's children have access to this scheme, I think the universality sells it. I think that's the kicker there. You know, public housing for poor people are like, oh, that's bad. You're getting something for nothing. Public housing for the military, oh, that's great. These guys are great. They deserve a free house. Public housing for the prime minister, oh, that's fine too. Give him two houses, right? They spent something like $17 million renovating the lodge, I think, in Canberra. And I'm like, well, the Prime Minister doesn't need a free house. He's the Prime Minister.
You flagged earlier on there are winners and losers. Let's say your scheme is implemented. Who loses? Given that lower-income households in theory win, those who can't otherwise get into housing have that opportunity, there is a trade-off in theory, I suppose. How does it work out for everybody? How does the market respond? Not that it needs to be good for everyone. You're absolutely saying there's winners and losers, but tell us the other side of the equation.
Yeah. So the losers are essentially current landlords in areas where this would be popular, and property developers who essentially their customers are buying off, you know, what the scheme I call housemate instead of, you know, their product. But I actually think you can solve this. You're not going to solve everything, but I think you can minimize the political cost by letting developers tender parts of their project into the scheme, and using the sort of de-risking ability of government buyers to say, hey, yeah, you got that project of 100 dwellings. We'll buy 20 up front and we'll pay you on these great conditions, but we're going to buy 15% below the market because you're not paying an agent fee, you're not paying this, there's no risk, and we can pay you in installments rather than on settlement in 5 years' time. And so you can go, bring them on board by letting them participate. And I think it makes sense, right? You don't want to have to start. A property development is risky and hard. And after the First World War, I think I mentioned in the book at the end, when the government is very small, you've got to remember, it's only 5% of GDP in after Federation those first decades. Now it's 25%+, right? It was pretty small and incompetent. It just basically taxed imports and exports and built treasury buildings and stuff. And they had lots of problems because the governors of the states would buy land at inflated prices from their mates for the soldiers, and they would commission their mate's construction company. And all that same stuff, right, was happening 100 years ago when we tried it. I think we can do better than that, but I think using the expertise that exists in these private organizations is totally fine as well. You don't have to create a department to buy and build every dwelling. You can do that. One crazy idea is, estate where if you die without heirs, the state takes your assets. Deceased estates, put them in housemate. Send your little reno team up, put them in housemate, sell them off to these people. There's just so many potential ways to do this that are less susceptible to corruption and easy to capitalize on the expertise that exists in large private organizations already. I think that's a totally reasonable way to get buy-in from developers is also let's just say you engineered in the planning system some kind of bonus for contributing to a housemate. Well, then they love it, right? You give them a bonus, you get the de-risk finance. On these large projects, it means that if the market crashes between stage one and three, well, you're selling stage two to housemate and they're guaranteed income. So that's sort of how I would minimize the political pushback from developers who think you're stealing their customers. So what happened in the 1930s during the Great Depression in the United States, for example, is that when they started having a push for public housing, the landlord lobbyists got together and said, you can't steal our tenants, right? And you can't just compete with us. That's unfair. And so public housing had to be this niche, low-quality product only for the poorest people who were in overcrowded housing anyway and weren't really customers of that middle-class rental. So you can see that there is going to be that sort of effect, but I think you can minimize it by getting the development group. Like, you know, this is the best customer to have, right? It's the federal government.
Yeah, absolutely. Mate, last question on this one. I'll get to our favorite questions. The current concerns around, I've expressed it on Twitter, and I may be entirely wrong, is why I'm asking the question. We have a very, very, very low vacancy rate right now. We have a lot of people coming into the country, and at some point, speaking of equilibrium, there is an overweighting or an overbalancing. Whether you want to talk about that specifically, or maybe just supply more broadly under a housemate scenario, how would supply be equalised? How do we stop over or under building? How would that work out such that we'd have a vacancy rate high enough to do the right thing on prices, not so high that it gets out of control, that we have the appropriate development in the appropriate places? Is there a supply response needed, or does the market simply take care of that in itself anyway?
Okay. There's two very specific clarifying points to make there in response. One is that the vacancy rate that we call in Australia the vacancy rate is not empty houses. It is advertised rental houses, whether they're empty or occupied. So the vacancy rate is a measure of, I guess, participation in trades or turnover in the rental market. And that rate essentially is caused by the same economic forces that cause the rate of change in prices. So when the rate of change in prices is high, the vacancy rate is low, right? They're essentially the same. They're a different way to measure the process of price adjustment. Let's just put it that way. So I can look at vacancy rate and I can tell you rents are rising higher than they were last time because the vacancy rate is 1% instead of 2%. Or the vacancy rate 6%, I can tell you rents are falling compared to when they were 3%. Because it's the same process, it's a different way of observing the economic adjustment. So vacancy rates themselves are not like a thing you would target. They are just an indicator of how the market prices are adjusting. And it would be true if we had zero increase in population and zero change in the number of households and dwellings, that if incomes increased 20%, that prices would rise and vacancy rates would fall. Because vacancy rate, that's how prices rise, by people buying quicker, trying to get in front of the other person, right? And so that makes this fewer advertised things, and that's how we get the outbidding. So it's the same mechanism, and I think that's important to understand, because right now, yes, I think the high immigration is a bit of an issue, but as you would have seen, I think it, on the immigration question, we've got to get the rates and levels distinction right. So I say, you know, in 1924, people shouldn't be upset that the population was going to grow to 26 million in 2024, right? The fact that we added 15 or 20 million or whatever the number is not an issue for them to worry about in 1924. The issue is population growing 5% next year or 1%, right? It's that instantaneous rate, because everybody who, especially because immigration happens all at once and everyone needs a house, whereas children, they age out and move into households slowly over time. Because it happens all at once, I guess a good analogy is that the rental market, those currently advertised rentals this month, are like a doorway to the Australian property market. All right. And normally people go out the side door, they vacate, and they come back in the front door.
Yes, yes.
But what
yes.
we're doing is we're just jamming all these people from somewhere else through the front door.
In the front door.
Right. Yeah, okay. So temporarily you can get a queue, right? But what happens is as people exit, all right, they come back and they form bigger households, right? And as that cycle continues for the next couple of years, you will find that there's 11 million houses out there. People will spread out and fit in to all those houses. There'll be, you know, an extra one person in every 10 houses fits an extra million people, right? And you wouldn't notice. Like in my street, since I moved in here 10 years ago, there's probably five or six extra people in 12 houses, right? But that's just because of the turnover of different types of families and whatnot. And so that's five times more than what I said could accommodate a million people. It's just, it takes time for the market to adjust to that, because you have to adjust through that small doorway.
And so that's this location that we're feeling, as opposed to a problem in and of itself. Is it a timing issue? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
So I'm saying a million immigrants is fine for the property market. We can handle it. We just can't handle it this year. But if it was over 10 years, you wouldn't even notice, right? Because it's only like one extra person going through that door a month. And then as people leave, they go, I'll buy a new apartment. Oh, I'll buy a new house. I'll build a new house. I'll do this. All those adjustments happen. Property markets go slow, right? It takes years to decide to build a house and then to occupy it. And even longer for apartment buildings in the city, right? That's sort of my argument on immigration is, yes, there's a big short-term effect. No, there's not a big sustained long-term effect, right? It's the sudden and unexpected change that really stuffs up the market, right? Does that make sense?
Beautifully put. It does, mate. It's beautifully put. And you've done it fantastically. Mate, I could speak to you for hours. Instead, I suggest our readers, our listeners, sorry, should read your book. But before we get to finish, mate, I'm going to ask you our favourite four questions, because that's what our listeners love to hear. Let's start with the first one. I assume you consume a whole lot of stuff. What are you reading, watching, streaming, podcasting? What's on the playlist?
Okay. Well, an interesting one that I've started is called Development Tank. It's a new podcast by a guy called Peter Kelly, who's had a YouTube channel for a long time talking about townhouse developments in Melbourne. Okay. And literally the nitty gritty. How wide is this street? How do you get a driveway across here? Where's the telephone pole? Can you cut that tree down? What should we buy? How do you sell How do you get the extra, you know, guest suite with the ensuite? And, you know, is a pool worth it in this suburb? Development Tank is a new podcast. Little Fish Media is sort of their YouTube and podcast channel. But if you're interested in the nitty-gritty of townhouse development in Melbourne, highly recommend it.
That's very niche, but I like it. I'm sure it sounds fascinating, honestly. Mate, we talked a lot about trends. We talked about housing, of course, and population and other things, and certainly that maybe the repetition, maybe they're not trends, maybe they're just cycles. But what trends are you keeping an eye on? What's fascinating you at the moment, whether it's in housing, corruption, the economy, society more broadly? What's fascinating you about the way the world is developing?
Yeah, good question. Look, I've got my eye on China at the moment.
Oh, okay.
Given the property bubble, or was it a bubble? I don't know, right? Because such a huge economic change. The question is, can countries have such an enormous period of growth and change and not have a massive crash? That is, like, that's an open question. And I think it's worth keeping an eye on policy settings in China and just their economy in general. In the next little while, it's probably I should probably pay more attention to it, but it's there in the back of my mind when I think about the macro economy in the next few years.
I've got to ask you then, what's your supposition? Can it develop that quickly without a crash? What's your best guess?
I think no. I think the question is how quickly, slowly the crash happens, who gets bailed out, how much you can manage adjusting all those balance sheets while also getting people to spend and employ people. It's an experiment, and my understanding is that Chinese bureaucrats understand this risk. The question is whether the political system allows for different choices or not. Yeah, it's going to be an experiment. I suspect there's going to be a correction of some form. I just don't know what it would look like. That's what's going to be interesting.
Fascinating. Mate, I normally ask what advice you would give someone in your industry or who's looking for a job in your industry. I'm not sure whether to ask that or whether to ask for advice about someone who was thinking about property. Feel free to answer that whichever way you would like. If you had to give some advice to somebody, what would it be?
Good question. Don't know. I guess for me, I don't know if you know, I wrote 500 articles on my blog between 2008 and 2018, which is just about one a week. So I think practicing things that interest you make you better. I was a terrible communicator. If you had found me in 2000, if you read some of my 2008 articles, you'd be like, this guy's just rambling. He's not getting to the point. Don't understand it. But 500 articles later, I got much better at explaining things. And yeah, practice makes perfect, but you got to have a passion for it or you won't put in the work.
Great advice. Mate, I don't know if you're an optimist or not. My final question is always, what are you optimistic about? So first I'll ask you, are you an optimist? And if you are, what are you optimistic about? If not, maybe why not?
Yeah, I think I'm definitely an optimist in the long run, acknowledging that it's not a straight line. Like, as an economist, I think you have to...
I was going to say, that's a very economist answer. That's
perfect. You have to zoom out sometime and go, just go look at some historical video footage, right, of the quality of people's houses and cars and how they used to eat. And just, it's, things are getting better. You have to just keep your eyes open. But it's true that in some periods there are corrections in the economy and many individuals do worse. And the question is, how do you have a system design that makes sure we get all that progress, but minimizes how many people have those losing periods or helps them get back on track in the meantime. So yeah, I'm definitely an optimist long term. I'm an optimist about corruption. Even as I said, you know, in the 19-teens, we had problems with corruption in property, and yeah, we've probably still got some, but I would say proportionally they're much more under control today, even though again, it comes in waves. So yeah, definitely a long-term optimist, but a realist in terms of it's not linear.
I love it. That is a great way to finish us off. Cameron, if people want to follow you, they can go to fresheconomicthinking.com. They can follow you on Twitter. You're Dr. Cam Murray.
Dr. Cameron Murray.
Dr. Cameron Murray.
C-A-M-E-R-O-N. On Murray.
Beautiful on Twitter. And of course, please go out and buy The Great Housing Hijack. I got nothing in it, by the way, but it is a great book. Cameron's a smart bloke. You'll be far, far better informed about the housing market. Everyone should read this book before commenting on property, frankly. Most won't for various reasons, but it's a wonderful, absolute credit to you. Well done and congratulations.
Thanks, Scott. I appreciate your support, man.
This podcast is hosted by me, Scott Phillips, produced by Ed Gooden, and imaged by Link Kelly.